We want students to be intellectually, morally, and aesthetically alive. And we care so deeply about that, we are going to rethink how we are delivering this content to our students. When we give students a real object in elementary school math, we do it because it teaches students that math is grounded in the real. It's not a bunch of tips and tricks made up by mathematicians for job security.
Jake Tawney serves as the Chief Academic Officer for Great Hearts Academy, a network of classical charter schools across multiple states. Previously, he taught high school mathematics and computer science and courses in Euclid and the philosophy of mathematics at Josephinum, a pontifical college. Listen in as we discuss the definition of classical education, the nature of mathematics and its place in liberal arts, and the classical education movement in America. Benedictine College is transforming culture in America, one conversation at a time. From our studios in Atchison, Kansas, these are the Benedictine Dialogues.
All right, Jake, welcome to the Benedictine Dialogues.
Great to be here.
So good to have you here. Really been looking forward to this conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time to come in here and have a conversation. And maybe to kind of start us off, tell us a little bit about the idea behind Great Hearts and what you guys are accomplishing throughout the country, really.
Sure. So Great Hearts is a system of classical schools. It was founded about 20 years ago. Mostly what we're running is classical charter schools. We have that in three states, four major regions. So we have it in Phoenix, Arizona, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, San Antonio, Texas, and then also just opened a brand new school this year, a beautiful school in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, with hopes to expand into Florida and other places as we move forward. We also have two online schools, one in Arizona and one in Texas. And this year we have two new private schools that were opened in Arizona under the new ESA law. We're a system of schools dedicated to classical education. We've been doing that from the beginning. Classical education, of course, exists long before Great Hearts did. But in some ways, Great Hearts was at the forefront, at least of the classical charter school movement. Mm-hmm. Before that, the whole movement was, in some ways, carried forward by small Christian schools, by homeschoolers. And 20 years ago, the founders of Great Hearts had just a marvelous vision to say, we're going to take this out of the private sphere and we're going to bring it into public education. And so our mission, quite boldly, is to form the hearts and minds of students through the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty.
What was it like getting into charter arenas? I'm always interested in how classical schools work with the local governments and things like that, and how that, is it symbiotic right away, or is it kind of a little bit of a process?
Well, it's highly creative work, right?
Sure.
So as you would imagine, folks who get into classical education are very mission-driven, they're very philosophy-driven, they're very idea-driven. They have a pretty good sense of what it means to educate students from kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade. The state also has a sense of what it means to educate a student from kindergarten through 12th grade, and that comes mostly in the form of curricular standards.
Sure.
Now, the states are pretty good about not mandating particular pedagogies, though we are seeing in some ways, and this is a good movement, some of the states now mandating things like cursive in the elementary schools, things like phonics-based reading instruction. So they start to dabble a little bit in pedagogies, but largely they've stayed out of that. And really what we're talking about when you do charter schools in the realm of public education is the state standards, which is really curriculum-driven. And so it's highly creative work, right? Because we have a pretty good idea of what we want students to learn.
Sure.
We have this educational model that we think is really good, and then we have to tailor that and get it to fit within that state system so that we can, in good conscience, sign that piece of paper that says, yes, we've satisfied our contract with the state, and yet still in good conscience feel like we're delivering the model that we want to deliver.
Yeah, and I guess the crux of the question then is, what is classical education, right? I mean, and you had a great article recently answering, in a way, that question, and I thought you offered a really excellent balanced approach, because sometimes you have these kind of two extremes of what people mean by that. So maybe you could share a little bit about the idea of what is classical education.
Yeah, I mean,
education.
This is the question, right?
Yeah.
as the movement grows, it's the question that everybody wants answered, but it's also the question that's going to demand an answer at some point. You're referring to a delightful series run by Chris Perrin at Classical Academic Press, where he had several authors respond to this question, what is classical education? If it's okay with you, I'd actually like to start with Martin Cothran's answer.
Okay.
And I thought he gave just a splendid intro to this, where he said, look, when it comes to defining classical education, we first have to understand that pair of terms is redundant. that really what we mean is just education. right? In other words, maybe said negatively, an education that is not in the classical form is not a true education. It's not a full education. And so if we're going to try to define it, we start with the term education, which comes from the Latin educare, meaning to lead out. So a classical education is an education that leads students beyond themselves to discover the reality of things. Whether those things are the matter of the universe, right? The planets themselves. Whether those things are the perfect triangle that Euclid talks about. Whether those things are what it means to be human, right? Where you study human nature itself or to study the nature of the divine. Whatever the case may be, an education is trying to lead students beyond themselves to discover things that are true, right? And things that are good and things that are beautiful. And so it starts with the basic premise that there is objective truth, goodness, and beauty in the universe, and that those things can be known, can be done, and can be appreciated, right? And I want to point out that that's contrary to a lot of other movements that we see, which want to center education in the individual mind of the students, right? Now, I think classical education, properly understood, is student-centered. We care deeply for the individual dignity of every student. But it's not student-centered in, say, a Cartesian way, where all of reality is centered on the individual conscience, right? Instead, it's an education that leads students beyond themselves to the noblest things, to the things that are worth knowing. And so that's what education is. That's also what classical education is. Now, that's the elevator pitch, right?
Sure.
What I tried to argue is really, in some sense, to try to avoid two extremes, because I think we're seeing both extremes in the movement right now, right? One is because folks who get into classical education are so passionate and are so driven by ideas, they also tend to look at the model that they've had and think that is the pure thing. Mm-hmm. And any departure from that is sort of anathema. And I do think we need to avoid that. We need to understand that, you know, first of all, classic education is a movement. It's not a model per se, right? Now, the particular pedagogies, the content tradition, those are things that we receive with a spirit of docility, a spirit of humility. Right, but we can never lose the humility in thinking that the thing that we have in our particular school is the only way to do it. Right. On the other hand, as the movement grows, it runs the opposite risk, which is as long as we have some students in uniforms and desks facing forward, and maybe we put some Latin instruction in, then we can call this classical education. And I think we need to be careful of that too. So there is a reality that has a tradition of what it means to educate students. And we do need to understand and submit ourselves to that reality, but without thinking that every little detail that we've incarnated in this instance has to be held, otherwise it's anathema and should be rejected.
It kind of reminds me of Europe in a lot of ways, in that the fact that their education system came out of a lot of their cultures. So there was the overarching themes of the Greek culture that they were learning, the Roman culture that they were learning, the great books, the great ideas that were continuing. But you had a German system. You had, you know, you still kind of do it, an English system and several other different ways. But it came out of the ideas of the people that were accomplishing it. And it wasn't necessarily this like one all be all. And I honestly think that would have done a disservice to several of these, because that's how they learned. They knew the German people, they knew the English people. And oftentimes, you know, people in Phoenix might be different than people in Dallas. And so how does that, you know, change? And how does it kind of morph into something a little bit more, not standard, but like for those people themselves? Does that make sense?
Yeah, the brilliance behind Chris Perrin's series is that he knows full well that any elevator pitch is insufficient for defining classical education. But one insufficient way of defining classical education is to say it's an education based in a tradition. And it's fundamentally based in the Western tradition. But I think you're right, that it takes on a particular incarnation in the here and now, right? You know, one of the books, for example, that's held up as at least at Greathearts, and I think in a lot of classical schools, as one of the pinnacles of literature is something like The Brothers Karamazov. But we should recognize that book's not that old. So there was a time when education was happening without the Brothers Karamazov.
Sure, yeah.
And so there is an evolution that can happen. There's a particular way in which pedagogues, educators, need to take the tradition that is classical education and adopt it to the here and now, right? The now and the here is 21st century America. And that is going to look different than it did in, say, 19th century Germany, right? All of those things are going to take on their own particular nuances. But what they hold in common is that it really is trying to educate students in their tradition. You know, for us, it's tradition of the West, the tradition of America, and then, as you said, even the tradition of Phoenix, the tradition of Atchison, Kansas, and what that means, right?
Yeah, and you also have, of course, the introduction of technology in a way that has never ever existed in human existence.
Correct.
So being able to form students and how to handle those things well, you know, while alongside classically training them, right, to better understand these things in the reality that they're going into.
Well, the most important technology that changed the face of education itself, of course, is the printing press. Yeah. Right, so we can't, again, we want to have a continuity of say organic growth in what it means to educate students classically, but we want to avoid a sense of antiquarianism. Right. If we were antiquarian about it, we really probably should not even have books. Right. And Plato, in fact, argued that you really shouldn't be writing things down and reading them because it will destroy the memory. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is worth thinking about. But I don't think we'd get very far in developing and really pushing classical education forward if we said we're actually going to get rid of even the technology of the book. Mm. But you are on to something with adopting the model of classical education to the here and now, and how that plays out with the adoption or, in some cases, the very careful rejection of certain technologies. Mm-hmm. Because right now, technology is changing so quickly, and I think another principle of what it means to educate is tried and tested methods that do change and evolve, but they change and evolve very intentionally and over time. And so that poses a particular problem for classical schools right now, which is, you know, what are you going to do with technology? And just when you think you have your minds wrapped around iPads, ChatGPT's out there, and now you have to wrap your mind around that as well.
Yeah, and it's an interesting time forming students because you want them to have a classical mind and a moral imagination prepared to go into the world to deal with these things, but you want them to go into the world as entrepreneurs, as doctors, as, you know, physicians, as whatever you want to call it, but they're going to have to deal with the modern world and the technology that it provides. And so the best thing to do, I guess it would seem, is form the conscience, form the moral imaginations so that when they deal with these things, they know how to do it virtuously.
Yeah, it's not just form the conscience or the moral imagination. That, of course, is fundamental and it's important. But it's also forming their knowledge of and their understanding of real things. Mm. Right? So at Great Hearts, we have well over 50% of our students go into STEM fields. Mm. And we do that without much technology in the classroom at all. And so I would have a couple arguments there. You know, one is that students, kids, teens, turns out they don't actually need a lot of training in technology, right? Yeah. They often know it, and I would argue virtually all the time, they know it better than their teacher does, right? And so I don't think the school has a particular need of having to form students in technology. They're being formed by it just merely by the culture that they're in, right? So we do need to understand that while it is absolutely the job of a school, of a teacher, of a school leader to form students and to develop a culture, that is one particular area of their lives. These students are also involved in culture in many other ways. And in those ways, they're getting ample exposure to technology, right?
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is to educate students in real things, right? And so even in the approach to technology, we want them to be able to evaluate it, not just morally, but I would also say in a broader philosophical way, right? What does it do to the human person? So it's not merely a matter of right or wrong or virtue. That's important, right? We certainly don't want students to use technology as a vice. But nor do we want them to overuse it to the point where it forms them and takes them away from the physical world. Mm. Technology has a basic way of forming everybody. It will form you. Neil Postman said that it will form you by its use, not merely by its misuse.
Mm. Yeah. It reminds me of kind of Plato's cave, right? Like you want them to know the really real. you know, not just the shadows on the wall. So now if we could get into a little bit of your background. I know you've got some expertise in mathematics and some background in mathematics. And I'm interested in your perspective of that, especially in regard to classical education and how to classically train people in mathematics.
Well, let's get one thing sort of straight from the beginning. I appreciate the question being asked in the context of classical education, because oftentimes we will hear some people say, you know, we want a school that does classical education really well, and we want math and science to be pretty good too. As if to say it's an add-on, right? And it's not. The ancients understood that there were seven liberal arts. And the first three are the arts of language, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, right? And if you understand something about kind of the history and the symbolism of numbers, right, as Catholics, you would understand the symbolic, the symbolism of three is the eternal. And the arts of language are eternal, I would argue, sort of in two ways. One is, if you will, sort of vertically throughout time, right? The laws of logic will always be with us. They don't really develop at all. They're certainly always true. But they're also, the laws of language are also eternal in a horizontal way, and maybe eternal is not quite the right word there, but what I mean is they reach across all the disciplines. So whether you're teaching history or mathematics or science or language, we're all professional rhetors. So we all need the arts of language. But the other four, the quadrivium, so alongside of the trivium, the other four really are branches of mathematics, at least as the Pythagoreans and the other ancients understood it. You know, obviously we have arithmetic, which is the study of discrete quantity. And then alongside that, geometry, which is the study of shape or continuity, continuous quantity. But they also had astronomy, which sounds to the modern ear like a science, but what they really meant there was geometry in motion. So geometry is a study of the continuous at rest, but astronomy is the study of the movement of the heavenly bodies, so it's the continuous in motion. But even for them, music related to arithmetic. So arithmetic is the study of the discrete on its own, whereas music is the study of the discrete in relationship or in ratio to itself. If you play guitar or any stringed instrument, you have a sense of, you know, various ratios. You cut the string in half to make certain overtones. And so I'm just a passionate advocate for saying, we do classical education, we do the liberal arts, and because of that, we have strong humanities, strong math, and strong science. They are part of what it means to educate a student, right? We are radically incomplete as human beings if we do not learn to think scientifically and to think mathematically. That's in fact why we teach mathematics. We don't teach it because it is useful. We teach it because there is something unique in the human soul that can only be satisfied by thinking mathematically. Mm. And the audacious part is, I actually believe that. And so what that means is, if that's true, I also believe that if we don't learn to think mathematically, there's something missing in us. There's something crying out to the heavens to understand the nature of the perfect triangle, the nature of prime numbers. Not because they're useful, though they are, but because they are worth knowing in and of themselves.
Well, wasn't it Euclid that said something along the lines of logic is God's math, right? So we're participating in a mathematical reality that's even beyond ourselves by going into logic. And so it reminds me of, I mean, Plato himself thought that for the first several years, a student or a mentor ought to work mainly with numbers and learn how to do numbers. Why would they be so passionate about that to begin with?
Yeah. In fact, I think because mathematics is the discipline that bridges heaven and earth.
Mm.
Because it has an incarnation in the created universe. We know this. So even though I'm a passionate advocate for studying math in and of itself, we also know it has marvelous applications because there is, excuse the pun, continuity, right, mm-hmm. between the ideas of mathematics and the creation of the universe. Ratzinger used this as a proof, if you will, for the existence of God. The fact that the human mind, the laws of mathematics, and the creative universe all seem to be, they all seem to gel together, means there must be something holding them, right? Something above all three. So mathematics reaches down to earth. We know this. We know that it is the language of creation. But it also reaches up to the heavens because it is not material. Mm. When Euclid is studying the triangle, he is studying a perfect shape that he has never seen. We have never seen the perfect triangle. Anything we've seen in this universe is an approximation of it. I mean, at the very least, you can't draw a perfectly straight line.
let alone you can't make something infinitely thin. And yet, this pure ideal, this thing of the gods, we can say true things about that. And so mathematics not only reaches down to earth, but reaches up to the heavens. And I think that's why the ancients were so fascinated by it, because they knew it had something to do with this familiar world we live in, but they also knew that it was more pure than all that. It reaches up to the gods, and you bring down those ideas and you hold them as permanent. And that's why math has a higher level of certainty than something like the progressive inductive method of learning and discovering new realities in science.
Mm-hmm. What would be a classical approach to math versus maybe a modern approach to math?
Yeah.
What are some of the differences?
I'll give you a few highlights. I mean, this is another question where an elevator speech is difficult, right? But I think I can say a couple true things about it. So one is math needs to be taught qua math. It needs to be taught as mathematics. And so it cannot be reduced to one of two things. The more obvious thing is application, right? So we don't want to reduce the learning of math to application itself, right? This is why, even though and we do actually pair our calculus and our physics together, and there's a lot of good that comes from that, but we caution our teachers in doing that because we don't ever want mathematics to be at the service of the scientific realities. There are things that we should study in math, even if we're not finding parallels in the science that's paired along with it. So we don't want to reduce math to application, right? But nor do we want to reduce math to, say, philosophy of math or to the history of math. Now, here I want to be careful because I actually do think that a classical approach involves some conversations about what is shape, what is number, what is continuity, what does Euclid mean by a straight line, how does that align with how Descartes conceives of a line as a system of points. We should have those conversations. We also should integrate original sources so that people understand that math is a living discipline that has its own tradition. It's the knowledge that we have of mathematics is the product of real men and women and their work. So we need history. We need philosophy, but we can't reduce mathematics to that. And we do see some of that tendency sometimes within the classical movement. Outside the classical movement, we see the other tendency. So that's one principle, right? We want to teach math as math for the discipline that it is. The second principle is that we want, as with all classical pedagogies, to proceed Socratically. And that means starting with the phenomenon itself. Right? So as an analogy, in a science class, the classical approach would be to start with the experiment, start with the biological thing, and make observations. We don't say, here's the law we're studying today, let's give some details about it, now let's show you an example of it. We go the other way around. That's true in literature when we start with the book, and it's true in math as well. In math, the thing, the object of study, is a problem. No, it's a thing itself, right? It's a number, it's a shape, but the question surrounding it ends up being articulated as a problem. Students, all new mathematics needs to come out of a need, not a practical need, not an application, right? But a need for the mathematics itself. Why should I care about factoring polynomials? Like really, why should I care about that? It needs to come from some reality, right? It needs to come from some need to discover that new math technique. It's guided by the teacher, but it needs to start with a problem. And that problem, this is not rocket science, right? I'm not talking about a super creative problem that's gonna take all a period to solve. If you want students to learn to factor polynomials, you can simply start off with a quadratic equation and have them try to wrestle with solving that. Because up until that point, they will not have had techniques to do that. They need to wrestle with that problem so that they feel the need for the technique. And so every math lesson, every new concept needs to start with a problem. That's true in elementary school, by the way. Even in elementary school, where they're in sort of that grammar stage, as Dorothy Sayers would describe it, where we want a lot of technique and memorization, they still should start with a phenomenon. They should start, I would argue, there with a physical object so that they know that the math is grounded in the real and can abstract from it. So this principle of Socratic inquiry, that questioning surrounding an object of study, exists from kindergarten all the way up through calculus.
So that's the second principle that I would adhere to. The third, I guess I kind of already went into in the discussion of the content of math, but I do think we need to have original sources in there, right? Mm-hmm. I think we need to understand that mathematics is the result of real men and women, that it has a tradition in the same way that the history of ideas has a tradition. The pinnacle of that, of course, comes, at least for us in our geometry class, when we teach them geometry using Euclid's Elements.
Thank you for listening to the Benedictine Dialogues. We'll be right back to the show after this brief message.
A reckoning is coming. And this reckoning is so important for us to understand. There is so much at stake. If we don't win this battle for freedom in the U.S., socialism will prevail. And the key to success is virtue in business. Faced with the question, is capitalism the economic system of choice? Believe it or not, the popes asked that question, and they answered it. We have to reclaim that moral tether that's going to allow us to operate a well-functioning free market. I'm Dave Guinens. Welcome to the series, The Reckoning, where we explore the ultimate battle for freedom in the United States between socialism and virtue in business.
To enjoy this free series, visit media.benedictine.edu. And now, back to the show.
I love the fact that there's a movement going on in this country to try to push towards classical education. And in fact, there's a lot of schools out there that have had modern education in a lot of ways, and they're trying to kind of transition to classical. Have you had some experience with that, and what advice you might offer to schools that are trying to do that?
First piece of advice is, it can be done. There are schools doing this all over the country. It can be done. As the movement grows, you're finding more and more schools either doing it out of desire or in some cases doing it out of necessity because enrollment is down, right? And they're realizing that classical schools have waiting lists. All of this is good, right? So piece of advice number one is it can be done, right? Piece of advice number two is you need to think very, very carefully about communications plans, right? We see this, I hate to be practical, but we see this project fall apart more. When it falls apart, more often than not, it's because it was not properly explained. And we often think to the parents, and that's true, but I would argue equally as important is the teachers themselves. Teachers, it's the most noble profession there is. They deeply care about their students. They want to do good for them. So we need, if we're going to transition a school of teachers who maybe have not had experience in that, we need to bring them along and sell it. We need to get them to understand that this is a good for students. The third piece of advice I would give is you got to go visit schools. I mean, look, one of the principles of classical pedagogy is this idea of mimetic instruction. It's instruction by imitation. Students learn to draw by imitating the masters. Why would we not think that's true for teachers learning how to teach or for heads of school learning how to lead a classical school? You need to go see the thing in action. And I would say you need to go see, you know, five different versions of it so that you can start to understand the differences that are there, but also get at the core, right? And then three, take your time, right? You can do this over 3 years. And I think the advice of choosing a discipline, two disciplines, maybe a year, and kind of working your way through that so that particularly in elementary schools, as it's often the same teacher teaching all the disciplines, it becomes very overwhelming if you're going to do all of them at once. I would argue first and foremost, I would start with literature. I'd probably toss history in there because it would pair nicely for some revision in the first year. But I think getting your reading list right, so I say literature, I actually mean all of ELA, right? Getting your reading instruction to be phonics-based, if it's not already, getting your reading list set so that you have good literature you're putting in front of students, and then really working with teachers on what Socratic inquiry around literature looks like. Because that is, in some ways, the most obvious application of Socratic inquiry. You have this story you all read together. Let's ask questions about it. Let's dig deep into it. Let's understand what that means.
I think, too, sometimes what ends up with a little bit of pushback is, and I think you brought it with the very first question, is the idea of classical itself. Oftentimes, teachers who've been doing the same thing for 15, 20 years, they don't understand why would we want to go back to an old way of doing things. And so I love the idea of like, well, this is education. Like, this is real education. So the idea of leading towards, we want to educate our students, we love our students, we want them to be educated at the best possible, you know, note. And this is it. This is a way in which we can do that.
But the selling point there is formation, not effectiveness,
yes.
Right? Classical education is highly effective, right?
Yes.
It's highly effective because it puts first things first, right? It puts the anthropology first, the understanding of the human person first, and it puts formation on top of that. Because of that, it becomes highly effective. But if you go out with an argument of effectiveness, there are, in fact, other educational models and pedagogies that have been deemed effective in certain areas, right? That's not primarily why we do these pedagogies, right? We adopt a pedagogy in a classical classroom, not merely because it is effective, but because it is formational. When we give students a real object in elementary school math, we do that not simply because modern educational psychology has said this is a very effective way in getting kids to get to the abstract principles that are in math. That's true, but that's not the first reason why we do it. We do it because it's for a philosophical and anthropological reason, because it teaches students that math is grounded in the real. It's not a bunch of tips and tricks made up by mathematicians for job security, right? The same thing could be said even for phonics, right? Yes, it's effective. It better be, because it's based in a sense of anthropology and a sense, in this case, of metaphysics of language, right? But that we don't teach it simply because it's effective. We teach phonics because it teaches the orderedness of language to students. That even in its exceptions, language is itself ordered, right? And so the sell to a faculty or the sell to a community does need to talk about effectiveness because they care about that. But the primary pitch is one of human formation. We care so deeply about the formation of the human soul, right? We want students to be intellectually, morally, and aesthetically alive. And we care so deeply about that, we are going to rethink how we are delivering this content to our students. And we're going to rethink the very content that we're delivering.
It's interesting. So I have high school kids, and whenever I go to, you know, events with other parents and stuff, no matter what, you're going to hear asking about job preparedness, college preparedness, things like that. When it comes to classical education, what is a good way to communicate the fact that these things will also happen? They will be prepared to go out into the real world.
The best way to communicate it, again, is to show the results, right? Greathearts has now been graduating students for well over 10 years, and they're getting into every university you can think of around the country. And that's not unique to Greathearts. That's true of every classical school. So, and parents actually understand that. They buy that, right? The hardest thing for a classical school is when they're starting a high school, because now you do have to address this question, right? Once you have your first graduating class, that apologetic starts to take care of itself. When parents see that students are going on into STEM fields, when they're going on to be artists, to be doctors, to do a wide variety of things, they start to get it, right? But the apologetic here, I would argue, needs to start to come even more loudly and clearly than it is already from the business sectors themselves, right? We already know this. When you talk to these businesses and say, what are you looking for? They're talking about well-roundedness. They use different vocabulary than we do in classical education, but they're really talking about well-roundedness, educational liberal arts. They want students who can speak, who can think, who can argue, right? Who can understand, who can problem solve. They want all of these aspects of education. What they might not understand is that all of that also comes from a certain set of content. Because at the same time, they also start pushing more STEM skills and more, right? But I think we need to, the schools need to work with industry, work with business sectors to get them to join that chorus of saying, we have seen the results. Now that the movement is growing, now that we have graduates out in the world, we have seen the results of this kind of education. We know it because this was the education that was around, for hundreds of years, and students were going off into the real world and being quite successful. What we need now is a unified chorus between the schools and industry.
Yeah, I've heard from actually a few different businesses the fact that a lot of times they're going to these liberal arts schools because the people that are coming out of them are hard workers and they're disciplined. They don't necessarily need somebody to prod them constantly. Yeah. They're willing to put in the work. They understand the job, that it's not just going to be, I want to put in my hours and go home. Like, they know this is what it takes. And to me, that comes from, again, a well-formed person that understands all of what we're talking about, all this kind of well-roundedness, kind of holistic person. So one question I also had was, could you offer any books that you would recommend for people who maybe they don't understand classical education, maybe they've kind of dipped their toe in it? What would be that, like, one or two books that you'd say, oh my gosh, this is the one I would hand to a person who is not convinced?
Well, for parents who want to just understand a basic introduction to sort of what is this model, to get a basic apologetic, Chris Perrin has a delightful book called An Introduction to Classical Education, something like a parent's guide. It's pretty thin. You can read it in one, maybe two sittings, and I think it's a great introduction for parents, right? If you're looking to do more of a deep dive into content itself, I would say it's Susan Wise Bowers, The Well-Trained Mind. It's a book written for homeschoolers, but she does a really nice job of going through each of the disciplines and saying, here's kind of how we approach this, and here's the resources, here's the various curricula that you can use to teach each of the disciplines.
So I always like to ask our guests, what advice or what would you like to see as far as something that we could do here and now to help transform culture in this country?
The three most important institutions in culture are the church, the family, and the schools. And so if we want to shape culture, we have to focus on all three of those. We're talking about education today, so we're talking about that third one. And that's where my heart is, right? If we really want to change culture, we have to get education right. Because culture is nothing except for people, right? It's the cultivating of people, but it's people themselves then learning to cultivate, right? To cultivate each other, to cultivate the world, the earth, right? And so education has a particular job in forming culture because it cultivates souls, right? Teachers are not scientists. They're not data scientists either. Teachers are craftsmen. They're craftsmen and craftswomen of souls. There is no more noble profession than that. And if you think about those three pillars of culture, that's what they all have in common. They're all crafting souls. And so teachers need to think about how they're different from pastors and parents, right? Because those are the other two people in students' lives that are actively cultivating souls. So the formation of culture in the here and now comes from those institutions. I would say with regards to education, what can we do in the here and now? Parents need to start thinking about what kind of formation they want for their students, for their own children, as they enroll them in schools from kindergarten, as they move them up through that, through the elementary years into the middle years and high school years. I would also boldly say that in the here and now, we need more classical high schools. We, of course, need more classical elementary schools or K-8s, but those seem to be growing more quickly. I'm worried, actually, about this gap of 9 to 12, that we're going to have a lot of students coming through the K-8 program with this desire for this model. Parents have this desire for this model. They see the benefits of it, and they have nowhere to go from 9 to 12. And it's not that any year is more important than others in terms of formation, but there is something very unique right now in students' lives of the 9 through 12 space and then the college space and the formation that is offered to students. And I'm very worried that we don't have enough classical high schools, because it turns out I think it's actually harder work, in part because it's harder to sell to parents, right? And so that's one thing I think we can do in the here and now, is to push more high schools to start to think seriously about what it means to be a classical high school and to make that move, or to take operators who know how to start schools and to give them the resources to be able to start to launch more classical high schools.
So we need great heart high schools, all across the country, is what it sounds like.
High schools, yeah. All across the country.
Well, Jake, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for all your work and coming here to campus. You're here for the symposium on transforming culture, so it's a perfect time to talk about this kind of stuff. And thank you again for watching. And if you be sure to check out our website, media.benedictine.edu, where you can check out the rest of our episodes. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter as well. Thanks again for watching, and God bless.
We hope you enjoyed the Benedictine Dialogues, a production of Benedictine College in Atchison, Kansas. To catch all the latest and support our growing platform, visit media.benedictine.edu. And be sure to recommend this show to your friends and family. Help us to transform culture in America, one conversation at a time.